CrimeCon UK, the ultimate true crime event, returns to London on the 21st and 22nd of September 2024.
CrimeCon UK is the world's leading true crime event and is partnered by True Crime, the expert-led channel available on your platform of choice.
From fascinating sessions with some of the biggest names in true crime to raising a glass with your favourite podcasters, us, CrimeCon UK is an unforgettable way for you to really immerse yourself within the true crime community.
We will be there, and we know quite a few of you are coming already. So if you haven't got your ticket, what are you waiting for? Come and join us at CrimeCon UK on the 21st and the 22nd of September in London.
Quote red for your special 10% discount. And if you're a Patreon supporter, do let us know before you get your ticket if you are planning to go, because we have an extra special discount for you. So head to crimecon.co.uk to book your tickets today. Hello and welcome to Seeing Red, a true crime podcast. I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan. Welcome back, guys, and thank you for joining us this week. Apologies that we missed a week last week, but Mark, are you feeling any better?
Oh my God, I am so much better. I think everybody who knows me is fed up of me boring the arse off them about being ill. So I know it's really boring, but yeah, I had vertigo and it was... honestly, it was debilitating. I was in bed being sick for days and days. I now have absolute sympathy for anybody who suffers from that, but it's absolutely passed. I've had some anti-sickness pills, which did the trick in the end. But yeah, it was not fun. So thank you for your patience whilst you awaited the episode. I will just say, Bethan said you can't tell, but I feel like I might sound a bit out of breath. It's because I'm fucking stopped this morning just before we hit record. So if I sound out of breath, I will calm down as we get into it. And also, I'm recording somewhere slightly different, so if it is a little bit echoey, I will note that for next time and change the location.
Right, enough of your excuses. Let's crack on with the episode.
Yes, please. Okay, this week we are diving headfirst into the world of chemsex. How do you feel about that, Bethan?
I'm excited because it's not something that I've ever been involved in or experienced myself, but we've definitely covered a couple of cases before and it's fascinating. And I kind of get it because I understand why people would want to enhance their experiences. I kind of understand that. I can understand the reasons behind it, but it also terrifies me because so often we hear of people getting out of control or things happening, or, you know, there's been cases we've covered before where people have been given something by somebody else, which obviously is horrendous. So I'm intrigued as to what you've got for us this week. But it'll be a really interesting episode, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm glad you're looking forward to it. It is a subject we've visited or we've kind of skirted around a little bit before. But yeah, we're going to go deep on it this week. And yeah, I think it's a really exciting subject. It's not something I've had any involvement in, but I can understand it too. I can understand the appeal of it. And I think it's two fascinating subjects and we're putting them together, drugs and sex. And hopefully we'll, you know, all learn something, because I think the interesting thing that's come through to me in doing the research is it's not always about enhancing pleasure or performance. It can be done for other reasons. So, and not just reasons that are more nefarious, but it can be done to dull emotions, for example. So yeah, it's hopefully an interesting episode. So chemsex refers to the use of specific recreational drugs before and or during sexual activity, generally to enhance one's sexual experience. The drugs, typically methadone, gamma hydroxybutyrate, or GHB as it's more commonly known, crystal methamphetamine, and to a lesser extent ketamine, encourage disinhibition and enhance libido and stamina. We have, as you said, Bethan, we have, of course, been here before, dive into our back catalogue and you'll find episodes that do involve chemsex. Stephen Port, for example, Stefano Brizzi as well. But in today's episode, we are going balls deep on the subject as we discuss two very different cases that involve chemsex.
Balls deep, straight away with the innuendo, Mark.
Well, you know, there has to be a pun in here somewhere. And the cases are, yeah, very disturbing, actually, both of them. So there won't be any room for puns or anything as we progress. Before we get into it all, though, let's take a moment to thank our most recent Patreon supporters. Did you want to do the honours, Betham?
Yes, because I feel like I haven't for ages, so thank you for asking. A huge thank you to Emily L, Shalina, Terry Burke-Wolin, Eliza Boyette, Sinead Morahan, Ellie Putt, Rachel Hale, Gerianne Fitness, Lindsay Shaw, Colette Chambers, Sierra, Max Chapman. Thank you.
Thank you to each and every one of you. And of course, thank you to all of our existing supporters too. If you want to join these people, all you need to do is head over to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast. So I wanted to provide a little bit more context before we take a look at the two cases I'll be covering today. Chemsex is a fairly new word, but the idea of taking drugs to enhance sexual performance or pleasure is actually not new at all.
No, of course not. I mean, humans have been doing anything to change their brain and like to change their experiences for many different reasons since we've been humans, I guess. And then sex is always going to be a part of that.
Yeah, I mean, sex, I suppose it's a fundamental part of who we are as humans, and that's always going to have been there, that sort of need to procreate. So yeah, it's no surprise, I guess, that it goes back to the dawn of time. But yes, pretty much since the dawn of time, people have been combining sex and drugs in one way or another. It's just that we didn't really have a name for it hundreds or thousands of years ago. And they weren't necessarily using synthetic narcotics thousands of years ago. It was kind of plants and toad venom, that kind of shit. Now we have a name for it. Chemsex is spoken about more, and to be fair, it is more prevalent than ever before. And because of this, there have been numerous studies and reports on the subject, which means that we have a lot more insight into it. So what do we know? Well, chemsex, sometimes referred to as party and play or PMP, particularly in the US, is more common amongst men who have sex with men. A recent study of participants in England found that 1 in 10 men who have sex with men had engaged in chemsex within the last year. So that's a pretty high statistic. 10%, 1 in 10 men who have sex with men in England would have potentially engaged in chemsex within the last 12 months.
Yeah, that is quite a high statistic, isn't it?
And that's not to say the practice doesn't occur within the heterosexual community as well. Indeed, we'll go on to hear that it absolutely does, but it is more common amongst men who have sex with men. And I'm not saying men who have sex with men can't also fall into that heterosexual category. I'm just trying to simplify things a bit. So
yeah,
you know,
I get it. Yeah, it makes...
Generally, heterosexual men don't have sex with men, but some do. Additionally, this same study found that men who engage in chemsex are more likely to be HIV positive. They're more likely to be born outside of the UK, and they would typically fall within the age range of 30 to 44, which is actually really interesting, that age range. And we'll come on to why in a minute. Chemsex is associated with disinhibition, and therefore people who engage in it are more likely to participate in risky behaviour, such as fisting, unprotected sex, and the sharing of needles. And of course, I think that's the first time we've ever said fisting on the show. I'm kind of glad we've got that out of the way. And of course,
I think it is.
And of course, taking drugs like crystal meth does also pose a risk anyway, such as cardiac arrest or your lungs might explode, that kind of thing. I made the last bit up, but I guess maybe that could happen. Scholars on the subject have hypothesized the origins of chemsex, and the general consensus is that drugs were primarily used as a way of enhancing performance rather than pleasure back in the day. So I think that's interesting. It wasn't really all about pleasure since the dawn of time. It was more to enhance performance. Then as new drugs were discovered, people came to realize that they could enhance both performance and pleasure. So they would find new drugs that would actually have an impact, not just on performance. I'm trying not to say on keeping a man hard, but I've just said it.
You've said it now, Mark.
I've said it. So, you know, yeah, drugs that wouldn't just necessarily do that, but ones that would actually make it a pleasurable experience for both the man and the woman.
Or the man and the man.
Or the man and the man, or the woman and the woman.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of just, yeah, anything that it's not just a one-sided thing.
Mm.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And I wanted to, in case I forget this point, and it's completely random, but I just kind of say it now. So I just, the other thing that kind of occurred to me as I did the research for this case, it's just such a dangerous mix, recreational drugs and sex, because with sex, the brain becomes quite impaired in terms of judgment. So that's why it can be a very dangerous mix in terms of people making choices and decisions they wouldn't make if they weren't in the midst of a sexual encounter, for example.
I suppose that's potentially where you're more likely to be HIV positive comes in, because actually, if you weren't having your judgment impaired, you may make more safe choices, you may ask more questions,
yeah,
and find out more about the potentials, the potential risks that this new partner or your partner poses. Whereas if your thought process is impaired in some way, or you just don't care as much, the idea that that person is HIV positive, you just don't want to use protection, or you decide to risk things. And it's, you know, that's, what's that phrase? Like, that's tomorrow's problem, or like, that's for tomorrow's me. It's not immediately thinking of something.
I think that's it. I think it just, it does encourage riskier behaviour all around, because inhibitions have been lowered. And I'm going to talk a little bit about HIV and actually the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, because in more recent times, the use of drugs before or during sex has actually been linked to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, and also with the rise in the number of sex workers. And I'm going to explain both of those points a little bit more now. So lots of experts on the subject have hypothesized that the practice is so prevalent amongst men who have sex with men, particularly those falling within that age range I mentioned earlier, so 30 to 44, because they were potentially so scarred by the AIDS crisis in the 80s, and therefore left with feelings of shame and fear when it comes to sex. And that, I do get that. That really does make sense to me, because I remember those. Do you remember those adverts, Bethan? I mean, you were born later than me, but I grew up at a time when there were adverts on the TV with tombstones and HIV. You know, it was just called AIDS back then. And it was, you know, it very much was a debilitating illness, and it was something that you would absolutely die from. But that very much has changed, and it's, you know, hopefully most people who are HIV positive will never go on to develop AIDS and will go on to, you know, lead a full and healthy life. But it very much was, you know, gay men in particular were blamed for spreading HIV.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I do think that scarred them. And I saw a film recently called All of Us Strangers with Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal, and it was absolutely amazing. And Andrew Scott's character, his character is gay in the film, and he talks about his reluctance to have intercourse with another man, because he basically talks about this, how he was so scarred growing up with those adverts on the TV, and it just got ingrained in him in those seminal years that if you have sex with a man, you will get AIDS, as it would have been called back then. So, you know, very interesting point, and you know, I really wanted to elaborate on that.
It's it's interesting, because even now, I think we talked about I can't remember the name, but in the case we talked about where the man had HIV, he was HIV positive, but he chose not to take his medication that would protect other people.
Yeah, Darryl Rowe.
I can't remember his name. So Darryl Rowe, that was it. So he purposefully made that choice to not take his medication, to potentially infect people. Yet nowadays, it like we said in that episode, it doesn't have to be a death sentence. It doesn't have to be what we were told it was back then. But people, I think, memories are still what we were told then. And
yeah,
even through the 90s, it was the same sort of message. But there hasn't been any sort of widespread campaign to actually make people aware of that's not true. That's not the case. Medicine has evolved. Our understanding has evolved.
And if people are taking the right medication and taking it properly, they're untransmissible. So they're undetectable, and therefore the virus cannot be passed on. So yeah, it's a very different world we're in, and it almost needs a complete rebranding. So let's talk a bit about sex workers. So chemsex is more prevalent within this community because, again, according to the experts, sex workers carry a lot of trauma too, a lot of shame, and therefore they use drugs to block out their emotions. And I thought that was really interesting because I had always assumed that chemsex was about having fun, enhancing pleasure and performance and stamina. But actually, and sadly, it can be used to block out trauma. Or actually, you know, on the plus side, it could be used to enable somebody to be intimate with someone and to help them resolve some of those feelings of past trauma. I'm not advocating the use of drugs, but I'm just saying it can help people. People taking ecstasy, for example, I think there have been studies on that. So
obviously there is a big difference, but who can honestly say that they haven't had, you know, a glass of wine, for example, just to help them chill out before something if they're nervous, or people who
right
are
now,
smokers.
Bethan. It's 10 o'clock in the morning.
I hope you have not.
No, I haven't.
Smokers who will go and have a smoke, or, you know, people who vape, for example. There's a lot of different things where you may choose to do something that changes how you're feeling in that very moment. Someone, you know, it's not a drug, but someone who goes for a run, for example. So whilst the things we're now talking about are potentially illegal drugs compared with something that is legal, it's an understandable need and an understandable thing for someone to do.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that all sex workers or all men who have sex with men that fall within that age group of 30 to 44 who engage in chemsex are doing that to block out trauma. I'm not saying that's the case, but it does make sense to me. And I think really my point in all of this is that chemsex isn't just about enhancing performance and pleasure. It can be about self-medicating traumatic experiences.
Yeah.
And of course, when it comes to the greater prevalence of chemsex in more recent times, the internet carries a lot of the blame. So we have apps like Grindr that can be used to promote the practice and to look for like-minded people. So hopefully that sets the scene for you. Let's take a look at the first case. Whips Cross Hospital, based in Leytonstone in East London, is home to one of the largest A&E departments in the country. And in 2018, it was also home to qualified doctor and trainee anaesthetist Jonathan Dean. Dean, at the time in his late 20s, had trained hard to realise his ambition of becoming a doctor. He was trusted by patients and colleagues alike, and to the outside world, he appeared to be a competent medical professional who had his shit together. However, the truth was somewhat different. Dean had suffered with severe depression and anxiety for many, many years, and as well as being a doctor and a trainee anaesthetist, he was also, unfortunately, an addict. Jonathan Dean used drugs and alcohol to self-medicate his mental ill health, and by 2018, his life was really starting to unravel. As a trainee anaesthetist, Dean had ready access to drugs, and by December 2018, he had started to steal them from work. On the 14th of December that year, he stole relatively small quantities of cyclozine, ondansetron, propofol, midazolam, and morphine. And by this time, the intention wasn't to actually use the drugs on himself, but to use them on his girlfriend during sex.
I'm sure you're going to go on to this, but was she willing? Was this something
she also wanted?
Okay.
Yeah, she was willing.
So the crime here is the stealing.
The crime is the stealing.
As opposed to he's not planning to go and use them on someone who doesn't know that they're going to be, you know, like a rape sort of situation.
No, I think that's what makes this case interesting. And there's no, there's also
I know this case. I feel like I recognise this.
There's no allegation of this being a controlling relationship either. So it sounds like she was very much willing and happy to take part in this. Now, before I go any further, I mentioned five very different drugs there, or some of them are quite similar. And I did just want to talk about these drugs because I think a lot of people have this misconception that controlled drugs are safe, or certainly that they're a lot safer than illegal drugs, but that is not the case. Well, I suppose it is if they've been prescribed to you and you take them as per the instructions. But if you take somebody else's prescription drugs, which of course is something I have never done, or if you've stolen drugs or bought them from a drug dealer, then they are not safe. They have not been prescribed to you. You're not taking them under medical supervision and you may not need them. You might be allergic to them. They may interact with other medications that you are already taking. So there can be dire consequences to this, and history tells us that. Heath Ledger and Brittany Murphy are two examples. So both died as a result of taking prescription drugs, and they hadn't been prescribed all of the drugs that they took. And there was a bit more to Brittany Murphy's death, but the pathologist did find 7 prescription drugs in her system that had not been prescribed to her, which certainly didn't help, which is, no, you know, very sad.
Thing. They're legal drugs for a specific purpose, but there's a reason why pharmacists have to only dispense them to the person the doctor has prescribed them to. There's a reason that there is that side of ensuring the control and this, you know, the control of who receives these medications, because yes, they are safe to support you right now. But even, for example, paracetamol, you can buy that over the counter, but if you take enough of it, it's dangerous. You know, it's kind of that sort of thing. You can buy certain medication yourself without even a pharmacist, but you should still take it in the manner it's prescribed, or the instruction leaflet. So then when someone else has been prescribed something for a specific purpose, it's, as you know, it can still be dangerous. So what he's stealing, somebody who's listening to this might think, well, I take that one thing, the third one you named, I take that. But that's very different to stealing it and then using it for your own reasons rather than for a medical reason.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start with morphine. Of course, most people will know what morphine is, but for those who don't, I will explain. Morphine is a strong opiate. It's very similar to heroin, and it's primarily used to treat acute pain. It's actually a Class A drug without a prescription, so unauthorized possession or supply can result in a custodial sentence. It's also highly addictive. If too much is administered or if it's not administered properly, morphine can result in respiratory arrest, unconsciousness, and even death. That's why it has to be used on the right person for the right reasons and under medical supervision. One of the side effects of morphine is nausea, and this is where the cyclizine and ondansetron come in. Both of those are anti-sickness drugs. One of the other drugs Dean stole, midazolam, is a benzodiazepine, often used as a sedative in a clinical setting, so maybe before an operation or during a procedure that you're awake for. Midazolam induces sleepiness and reduces anxiety, and that is a Class C drug without a prescription. And then finally, we have propofol. So many of you will be familiar with that particular drug because it's what Michael Jackson's personal physician administered to him pretty much every single night to treat his chronic insomnia. And propofol is an anesthetic. Basically, it's used to bring about a state of unconsciousness. And sometimes it's even used to induce somebody into a coma. This is not a sleep aid, hence why Michael Jackson is no longer with us. So these are all hardcore drugs. Well, apart from the cyclizine and the ondansetron, the anti-sickness pills. But just because we might not be familiar with prescription drugs doesn't mean that they are any less harmful than illegal narcotics when used outside of a clinical setting. And to be fair, they can even be harmful when they're used within a clinical setting.
And you're describing what these drugs do. And I say it too often because I then feel like I actually probably must be sounding like the judgiest person ever. But I don't like to kink shame. Even if it's not for me, there's obviously certain things I'm going to absolutely kink shame. And if it involves children or animals or dead bodies, I'm going to judge you. But I'm finding it hard not to judge this. A bit like when we talked about recently with the... and to be fair, we've had a couple of people correct us to say... And I feel awful for not remembering her name, but a recent episode where the young woman was completely taken advantage of by her boyfriend and he would tie her up for when they had sex. And actually, it wasn't sex at all. It was rape. And absolutely right. The people who got in touch with us and said, yes, it's a different word, but like, actually, it's very, very valid. It's a completely different situation. She did agree to be tied up, but not because she actually wanted to be. She was pressured into that. It was awful. And actually the time that she, when she died, it was not sex. They were not having sex. He was raping her. But I didn't, and I, you know, I don't get it why he needed to tie her up completely and have this kind of really submissive. I don't understand right now. And I may be wrong, but it sounds like he wants her under some sort of like sleep kind of thing, like as if she's going to be anaesthetized for an operation or something.
Yeah.
Like, what's he going to be doing while they're having sex? What is, I think I say it too much, but what's wrong with just good old fashioned normal sex? I don't know why she needs to be in a coma, for example. I don't know if that's what he's going to do, but why? Why not just have normal sex with someone who does it well and you both enjoy it? I agree.
I think you're preaching to the converted, and most of our audience will feel the same. Just to clarify, with that case you mentioned, he'd used insulin, hadn't he? So I think that was a drug that he was did using that on her.
Yeah, he chose to use insulin because he wanted to see how he could kill her, and that was, you know, that's horrendous. But even through their relationship, that was what he wanted her completely unable to move. Yeah. And I just think, what? I don't get it.
It doesn't make any sense to me. And what I can't understand is what is in it for the woman in this, who is going to be put into what is essentially a bloody induced coma.
That's what I'm so confused by.
She's not going to have a memory of it.
And she was fully willing for this.
Yeah.
If we're to believe them. That's just mad.
So these five drugs, morphine, midazolam, propofol, cyclizine and ondansetron, are commonly used to induce anaesthesia. And of course, we know that Jonathan Dean was a trainee anaesthetist, and this was his goal. It absolutely was, Beth, and it was to put his girlfriend under anaesthetic.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Anesthesia should only ever be induced in a clinical environment because a lot can go wrong. It's important for a person's heart and breathing to be continually monitored, for example. Very rarely an allergic reaction can occur. Sometimes even death can result, just in routine surgery as a result of anesthetic. The main goal of anesthesia is to provide pain relief, loss of memory and immobilization. And it's usually required during an operation which could, for example, involve a very invasive procedure like sawing your leg off or replacing your heart. And these are procedures that the human body and mind would just not be able to cope with normally in any kind of state of consciousness. So, you know, these drugs, this combination which together produces the anaesthetic, it's major stuff. The very fact that you could have your leg amputated and not feel anything or remember it is pretty impressive. When you're under anaesthetic, you are essentially in a very deep sleep. You are kind of dead. You don't dream. Your mind is not active at all. You don't feel the passing of time. So if you wake up 10 hours later, it will only feel like a few seconds have passed. It's very powerful stuff, and it's, you know, it's different to being in a deep sleep. It is different to that. It's probably closer to being dead.
And it is crazy, isn't it, that you would not remember anything, that even that part of your brain is completely switched off. I think that's also really, really fascinating and terrifying.
And doctors and scientists still to this very day do not understand how it works in the way that it does. They understand some of the components and why it does certain things, but they don't understand how this combination of drugs bringing about a state of anaesthesia actually does that. So I think, you know, that's kind of a little bit worrying, but very interesting. And I just wondered, Beth, and I don't know this about you, have you ever been under anaesthetic for anything?
I have, but only when I was a child, and I had four teeth removed in one go. So I had anaesthetic for that. A lot of the time I'd have like one tooth taken out or something at one time, and it would just be local. But when I was having like lots of dental work done for like braces and that sort of thing. So I remember having that done, and I really vividly remember they kind of put the mask over you and they say count down, and you don't get past, like you go from 10 and you don't really get past 5 by the time you've breathed in enough to count down from there. But the thing I always remember is my mum and dad must have prepared me really, really calmly and carefully for this, because I wasn't that nervous going in. It's a weird situation, but my mum and dad was, you know, sat there breathing in the mask. And then it was that evening, and I remember going home and having ice cream and feeling weird, but you know, it was to be expected. It was what was going to happen. But I remember then that evening saying to my mum, that was really quite fun. I kind of want to do it again because it was so weird, like falling asleep like that. It was just crazy. And my mum sitting there and going, well, actually, it can be really dangerous, and it's not something you do willy-nilly. And she kind of, I'm not saying that she then went, you could have died or anything like that. But I remember her being very serious and saying, it's not a fun thing. It could be dangerous. It's only done when you really have to. And that kind of then made me, I don't know how old I was. I must have been like 10 or something, 9 or 10. And that made me sort of sit up and think, oh, wow, okay, today was actually quite major. And I hadn't grasped the severity of it, because they'd obviously prepped me quite nicely to be like, you don't need to worry, it's all good. But they must have still, as parents, been really nervous. Like,
oh, yeah, of course.
How about you? Have you been put under anaesthetic?
I had a few operations as a kid. I had an operation a few years ago when we worked together, and I remember that vividly. I remember being put under, and I remember the anaesthetist reading out the drugs that she was injecting into me as she kind of injected them. And I remember one of them was fentanyl. And I remember she was, you know, as she injected it, she's like, can you feel that? And I was just like, oh my God, that is amazing. She just kind of, I remember having my midazolam, fentanyl, propofol I would have had. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You kind of get to about 5 and you're a goner. And then it feels like a second's passed and you're in the recovery room. It's it's a weird concept.
The weird thing as well that I then later found out, so sorry if any of our listeners, if you're eating or if you don't like teeth, for example, and I don't know if you know this, Mark, I don't know if you've ever had dental work done under anaesthetic, but the reason that they put you under a full anaesthetic for things like that, if it's really far back, really invasive, something they can't just do with you in a chair, is because they pop your lower jaw out of your skull.
Oh, I didn't know that, yeah.
And rest your lower jaw on your chest, so they've got a nice wide access. Isn't that so disgusting?
That after a week of being sick and feeling nauseous, that's put me right back there, Bethan. I can just,
I'm sorry.
Because I did have that done once. I had an abscess that had to be treated as a kid, and I think it was like an infected tooth. I had to remove the tooth. So, yeah, I had the gas and remember that. And, I did know that, but I'd forgotten it. So thank you for
the timely reminder. My pleasure.
So my point in going into lots of detail here is this stuff is very dangerous, even when being administered by an anaesthetist, especially, if it's being administered by a trainee one, then it's kind of even worse, I guess. And it's particularly dangerous when being administered in some random woman's home in Cambridgeshire. And I don't mean that Cambridgeshire is dangerous, just that administering anaesthetic in some random woman's home is a dangerous thing to do. That is not the done thing, is it?
No.
So
no,
this
it's
is
just, it just, that goes without saying.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes I clean the bathroom, Bethan, and I think, fuck me, I've done a brilliant job of that. You could perform an operation in here. It's so
But you
sterile.
Actually cannot. Yeah,
but I've actually never done
isn't.
That. So no. I've never actually invited surgeons round to do it, even though I could, because it's that clean.
And there's a big difference between a bathroom that's all tiles and you've bleached it to high heaven,
yeah,
and
gonna
a
be
bedroom,
grim.
Which is going to, you've got a bed and like there's a reason that there's not like a nice comfy mattress and duvet and pillows. Well, yeah. I mean, these people might not be doing it on a bed, actually. Well, who am I to judge where they
do it?
Well,
I don't know. It could have been her living room. It could have been anywhere,
but it's just not a clinical setting wherever they're doing it.
It's not. And could have is probably the right way to say this, because this is possibly what happened in late 2018 or early 2019. And I am going to deliberately use the word possibly there, because to be fair, Jonathan Dean has never been convicted of administering anaesthetic outside of a clinical setting. But certainly the idea in his head when he stole those drugs from work was to insert a cannula into his girlfriend at her home in Cambridgeshire and then administer that cocktail of five drugs into her in order to bring about a state of anaesthesia before then having sex with her. And yeah, the plan was consensual. Dean's girlfriend was willing to be anaesthetised. And in one text message to his girlfriend, Dean wrote, "Could get as much propofol as needed and morphine on top of that. Could put a cannula in you and do whatever I wanted. Feel like being unconscious while I do whatever I want to you."
Oh, wow. And what did she reply? Do we know what she replied? Or do we only know his messages because he was the one on trial?
No. And she has been named. She has been named, but I've chosen not to name her. She's not been...
I think that's fair.
...charged with anything, convicted of anything. She's done nothing wrong here. And I'll go on to talk a bit about that in a bit more detail. In another text message, Dean says, "Could have done anything to you. Fine line between you not breathing and you being unconscious. Good thing I'm a decent anaesthetist. Could fuck you senseless." And that last message does allude to the fact that Dean did enact this plan with his girlfriend, who, as I said, I've chosen not to name. The message is written in the past tense. It doesn't say "could do anything to you," as in we're planning something. It says "I could have done anything to you."
So yeah, it feels like they've done that and he's just talking about it, yeah.
But we don't know for sure whether they did actually go through with this, because Dean wasn't, as I said, charged specifically with this offence, although in his sentencing remarks, the judge did pretty much say, "You probably did do this, but I'm not really bothered whether you did it or not. I'm bothered that you stole drugs from the NHS, and that's what we're here to try you for today." So that's what his subsequent trial was all about. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves.
It kind of makes sense of her as well, that if she's willing participant, that she's not then going to press charges for some sort of reason. There's not going to be a reason for her to say, "He did this, this and this to me." Actually, if she was a willing participant, which it sounds like she was,
yeah,
if anything ever did happen, which it may not have done, but it sounds like it did, then actually there's no reason for her to push that. She's already been done for stealing drugs. That's bad enough. I kind of get that. We may not know, because she's not going to admit to it either way, because why should she? Why would she?
Yeah, and I don't know if she gave evidence or, you know, was interviewed under caution, not under caution, interviewed in any capacity, whether she answered questions or not. We don't know. She might have been, if she was interviewed by police, she might have been advised by her lawyer to answer no comment, and therefore there'd be very limited information as there is. What we do know is that Miss X, as I will refer to Dean's girlfriend from here on in, presented at a hospital in late 2018 or early 2019 following this anaesthetic sex or not anaesthetic sex. It is all quite vague, and the judge's sentencing remarks are too. But yeah, she presented at a hospital, not the hospital Dean worked at, another one. And that hospital alerted Dean's hospital that this whole escapade had been going down at her home in Cambridgeshire, and police launched an investigation. So I don't know, because it's not been reported, but it does potentially sound like Dean's girlfriend was put under by him, and then maybe she needed to go to hospital because she'd had some sort of reaction to the anaesthetic. I don't know. It does sound like that, though, doesn't it?
Or she presents at hospital having walked into a table and cut her leg open or something, but they're like, "Why are you so dopey?" And
great
then they realise, or maybe something along those lines, rather than and it's that she's not, because again, I'm totally making this up out of my imagination, but from the situation and the scenario, it sounds a bit like, "Oh God, you need to go to hospital, but don't go to my hospital." And
could be,
not
yeah.
kind of really getting that actually when they do some tests on you to find out what's up with you, a blood test is going to show all of this pretty quickly.
Yeah, it could have been unrelated.
It could be either or, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it also occurred to me, and again, I am absolutely speculating here because there's such a limited information. They could have split up. It could have been acrimonious. She could have gone to her local hospital to report what he'd done. Who knows? But, you know, the long and short of it is that following this trip to the hospital, detectives were alerted by Whipps Cross Hospital, which was a hospital Dean worked at, and his home was searched, and also the home of Miss X was searched, and drugs were found, drugs that Dean had stolen from work. I think they were found at his home, and he was arrested on multiple counts of illegal possession of a controlled drug. Jonathan Dean was initially suspended from his role at Whipps Cross Hospital before being allowed back to work, albeit in an administrative capacity. And the police investigation continued and continued and continued, because this was 2018 or 2019, it's a little bit vague, but then nothing really happened until Dean was actually rearrested in early 2023 when several ampules of propofol went missing from Whipps Cross, where he was still working at the time.
Gosh, so he's been caught.
Yeah.
And they're investigating him and he still can't help himself.
And the hospital was shit because they, initially suspended him, allowed him back to do, you know, desk work. He was supposed to have really restricted access to the hospital, of course, and his access card had not been amended, so he still had access to an operating theatre, and
Brilliant. It
was from that
That's
operating theatre that he stole the propofol. Yeah, so shame
Gosh.
On them. It was, you know, really quite shocking. Police searched Jonathan Dean's home and found needles, although I don't think they found any of the propofol. He'd probably used all of that on himself. And when police checked Dean's access card at work, they found he had accessed the theatre from which the ampules had disappeared at around the time they disappeared. So, you know, that's kind of what pinned him to this. You know, the propofol had gone missing. I think it was, you know, 12 ampules of propofol had gone missing. The hospital noticed that. They know that Dean is working there. He's got history of this. So they go to the police and report this. And they're probably reporting their suspicions that it's Dean. And then when they do an audit check on the access card records, it's all there. You know, he accessed the operating theatre at the time the drugs went. So it's pinned on him, rightly so. So ultimately, Jonathan Dean pleaded guilty to 9 counts pertaining to the theft of the drugs and 2 counts of possessing a controlled drug under the Misuse of Drugs Act. He denied 1 count of unlawfully administering a noxious substance, a mixture of morphine, propofol and midazolam, to Miss X with the intent to endanger life.
I kind of get that because there's no intent to kill her.
Yeah, there's not. And
I get that you wouldn't plead guilty for that.
Yeah.
Even if you know that that's dangerous, I don't think that's intent to endanger her life.
No, I agree, actually. And the judge ordered that that count under the Offences Against the Person Act 1861 lie on file. So it kind of remains on file.
Oh, wow. Maybe it's a bit of like, if you decide to go drink driving, you are aware that could kill someone. So he knew that that was dangerous. He knew there was a risk to her life. So even though my thing is, well, he didn't try and kill her, he was just going to have weird sex with her. He still knew what he was doing. There's still a risk to a person.
I don't think there was an intent to endanger life, but that he has to accept that if he actually did anaesthetize her, that was a possible consequence of it. And with regard to the 2023 theft of propofol, the judge accepted that Dean had stolen that with the intention of using it on himself only, which actually made me quite sad, really, because, you know, that is a really heavy duty drug. Out of all of those 5 drugs, propofol is the one that will pretty much kind of put you under. And that's what Michael Jackson was having administered to him to help him sleep, as I mentioned earlier. And, you know, if you're self-administering propofol, you've got a real problem, you know, a really serious problem, and it's incredibly dangerous to do that.
Yeah, and I know you said at the top that he really suffered with a lot of depression and his mental health. So to be in a point, I guess, you know, having the police breathing down your neck every day you're at work, you must be a very desperate person to then still risk you know, they're investigating you for stealing drugs and you're going to risk stealing more drugs in your work setting. But clearly he's that desperate because he does do it.
Exactly, yeah. And it was just temptation for him working in that environment. He was addicted. But, you know, the courts had very little sympathy with him in regards to his mental ill health, because their take on it was, you were a grown-ass man who knew where to get the help that you so desperately needed and you didn't get it. And I kind of do see that. I also kind of see the side of it that sometimes you're so mentally ill that you're not actually able to ask for help. So I do see both of it. But, you know, overall, it's just to tie that first case up, it's, you know, a really sad tale of a man who was self-medicating mental ill health, a man who wanted to get his sexual kicks from having sex with his unconscious girlfriend, which is not good, but at least she was in on the plan.
Yeah, it's more than a lot of the time we see on this show. At least
absolutely,
she was a willing participant.
But equally, this was a man who was in a position of responsibility, a man who stole controlled drugs from the NHS at a time when the NHS, well, always, you know, needs to not have controlled drugs stolen. But, you know, this was during COVID times. This, you know, the NHS was under such a strain. And yeah, you know, it was not good what he did. So, of course, Dean is finished as a doctor and now has a criminal record. He might struggle to find any kind of work. And he was sentenced to 25 months in prison. So I think he's this is a very, very recent trial. He is in prison right now. So, yeah, he was sentenced on the basis that his intention was to use at least some of the stolen anaesthetic drugs for sexual activity with his girlfriend. So whilst the judge wasn't necessarily saying you did do it, that was the intention, and that's, you know, definitely a problem. And yeah, his girlfriend wasn't charged with anything, and to be fair, she'd done nothing wrong. She didn't steal the drugs. She was willing to participate in this. So that is the end of case one. We'll move on to the final case now. This is a much shorter case, but it's a really interesting one that I wanted to talk about. And it actually concerns one-time drug dealer to Stephen Port, a man named Gerald Matavu. So Port, you might remember, he's currently serving a whole life prison sentence for the murders of Anthony Walgate, Gabriel Cavari, Daniel Whitworth and Jack Taylor over a 15-month period between 2014 and 2015. He lured his victims to his flat in Barking after meeting them through the gay dating app Grindr before plying them with lethal doses of GHB. I don't know why I called it a gay dating app. Apologies. It's just a dating app or a hookup app.
I don't think you'd find a straight woman, for example.
You wouldn't.
I don't think a straight woman would go on there to find a straight man.
No.
And
I just don't like it. You know, it's a bit like when people say, oh, I'm going to a gay wedding. And I'm like, you're just going to a wedding. Yeah.
I know.
So
but there was,
I'm like, is it a gay dating app or just a dating app?
I think, though, again, like we say quite a lot, you're thinking of this from a 2024 point of view. And whilst 2015 was not that long ago, it does kind of make
so
sense
different
within the context of the case and those young men and the lives that were taken, because actually Grindr was new, apps in general, dating apps and stuff was a very new thing anyway as well. So it does feel weird to say, but I get why you kind of have to specify it.
And I think, yeah, it's absolutely because of the time, that's how it is reported, you know, in the press when this story is mentioned. At his trial, it was revealed that Stephen Port had a fetish for sex with unconscious young men. And after killing his victims, he dumped their bodies in a nearby churchyard. So, you know, of course, we covered that episode a few years ago. Do go back and listen if you want a bit more information about that. So there is no suggestion that Gerald Matavu supplied Port with any of the drugs used to kill the four men. He was one of several drug dealers that Port had on speed dial, but he did plead guilty to supplying Port with methadone and GHB around that same time. So it could be that some of those drugs were used on Port's four victims. Matavu was sentenced to 12 months, 12-month community service order, 150 hours of unpaid work and 40 days of drug rehab in April 2017 for that activity, I was going to say, that offence. But his stint inside did nothing to rehabilitate his offending. Not long after getting out, Matavu, together with his boyfriend, Brandon Dunbar, began targeting men on the dating app Grindr. Just called it a dating app in my notes from here on in. Over a 19-month period, the two men drugged and robbed men in and around London. They arranged dates or hookups with their intended victims before injecting them with GHB, rendering them unconscious. They would then raid their wallets, stealing cash and cards, and usually the victims were reluctant to come forward to report what had happened to the police because they were embarrassed, which, you know, is heartbreaking.
That's horrible. That's awful.
Yeah. Or because they were not openly gay. So, you know, they may have been married to
that's
a woman.
Major,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine that? You kind of, something awful has happened to you and you don't feel that you can get justice because you're leading a, you know, partially a secret life and you don't want that to come out, which is actually fair enough, you know. So yeah, and you know, basically this meant that Matavu and Dunbar were able to get away with this for a year and a half, and they targeted at least a dozen men between them during this period. On the 16th of August in 2017, Matavu hooked up with a man on Grindr. That man was 54-year-old father of three and energy company worker Eric Michaels. Eric had come out as gay later in life in 2010. He and his wife had divorced shortly afterwards and they remained on really good terms, and Eric was active in his children's lives. I think most of his children were grown up, but he did have a 14-year-old daughter, so they were older children.
I love that though, that the husband love and wife were still able to become a different relationship then. Accept him for who he is, let him experience his life now in a different way, and that his children, he's still part of, you know, that's really, really lovely, because if you went back 50, 60 years, that just wouldn't have even been the case.
No, he would have continued to lead an unhappy life. Yeah. And I was really pleased actually that, yeah, he had the courage to do that later in life, to come out and live the life that he wanted to live. And I hope
I feel like this is going to have a sad turn.
Yeah, it
but
does.
But it did make me feel really happy.
Yeah. So, you know, 7 years after coming out is kind of where we're at. And Eric had been out in Soho on the day in question, which was the 16th of August, 2017, drinking in various bars when he went on Grindr and connected with Matavu. Eric invited Matavu back to his home in Surrey for sex. Matavu accepted and the pair made their way out of the capital and to Eric's house in the Home Counties. We don't know exactly what happened that night, but we do know that Matavu injected Eric with GHB and then proceeded to rob him of his possessions. He stole his laptop, his phone, his driving license, various bank cards and also bottles of alcohol. He then scarpered, and the next morning, Eric's 14-year-old daughter found her dad's body under a duvet with a syringe by his side. Yeah, I mean, I cannot imagine what that would have been like. And she would later say, at 14, I never expected to walk into my own father's house and find him lying dead in his bed. I would never want anyone to experience that. My dad was my best friend as well as my father. I could literally talk to him about anything. So it's really hard to accept that I have lost both. And I think she means both, you know, a best friend and a father. So absolutely heartbreaking. Matavu was charged with Eric Michaels' murder and remanded in custody. So his prints were found on the syringe. These would have been on file, of course, from his previous conviction. So he was easily caught. And when officers searched his home, they soon discovered that this was not the first time that he had drugged and robbed a man that he had met on Grindr. So they also then questioned his boyfriend, Brandon Dunbar, and ascertained his part in previous robberies, although he was not actively involved in this one, actually. Ultimately, Matavu was convicted of 6 counts of administering a noxious substance, 7 thefts, 6 counts of fraud, murder, assault by penetration, assault occasioning actual bodily harm, and possession of GBL drugs. GBL is a derivative of GHB, and he was sentenced to 31 years in prison. Dunbar of Forest Gate, East London, was found guilty of 3 counts of administering a noxious substance, 5 thefts, 6 counts of having articles for fraud, 2 frauds, assault by penetration, assault occasioning actual bodily harm, and dishonestly retaining wrongful credit. And he was sentenced to 18 years in prison.
They seem like pretty decent sentences.
Yeah, agreed.
For the crimes. I'm quite pleased with how long those sentences are.
Eric Michaels' ex-wife, Diane Michaels, said losing him was the worst kind of nightmare and that it had left her to bring up their 3 children. Reading a statement in court, she said, "My view of the world has changed. I was always a glass half full type of person. Now I view people with distrust and am wary of my ability to judge others accurately. This has been exacerbated by the callous disregard for Eric's life that has been displayed in court by the defendants. I never imagined people could be so wicked, and my fear and anxiety for the safety of those I care for is now unimaginable." And I just wanted to very briefly mention what she's kind of referencing there. So in court, Matavu lied and said that Eric had tried to rape him, and that's why he had injected him with GHB, which was complete bullshit.
What a horrible lie to
Horrible, vile thing to say, and for his family to hear. Eric's son, Josh Michaels, 24, said the impact of losing his father was unreal. He said, "I live in regret that I didn't see my dad every single minute of every single day. We would do him proud, as he always used to tell us." He said, "You have taken away all the lessons my dad had yet to teach me and all the experiences he deserved as a father, like meeting his grandchildren and walking his daughter down the aisle. To me, my dad had the answers to everything and was always the first person I would go to for advice. He was everything to me, and I'm completely and utterly lost without him." It's so upsetting, and it is a briefer case, and it's not one that we would have been able to feature on the show, but I wanted to kind of do it by, featuring 2 cases so that we could include this.
Just so that we can remember Eric, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, just very, very sad. Really brave man who made that decision to come out in 2010, later in life, retained this amazing relationship with his wife and his children, went on to, for 7 years to live his authentic life. And, it all came crashing down for him because he just met the wrong person. And there is no way to finish the episode that is positive. So I will just say thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode. So we will see you then.
See you then, guys. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, angels. It's your girl, Louise Rumble, and I'm the host of the Open House podcast. Therapy quite literally changed my life and sent me straight into my hot, healing girl era. Now, each week, I share my story, the good, the bad, and the downright juicy, and chat with some of the world's best therapists, psychologists, and wellness experts. From love, sex, and dating to attachment styles, nervous system regulation, wellness hacks, hormone balancing, and more, nothing is off the table. I've emptied my bank account on therapy and healing so you don't have to. So if you're ready to leave the past in the past and build the future you've always deserved, me and my favorite experts are waiting for you on the Open House podcast. Listen now wherever you stream your podcasts, and I cannot wait to meet you.